first of all, Dana, thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us. It's really greatly appreciated.
Well, I always like to talk with my brothers and sisters.
So let me give you a quick introduction. You know, Dana really has been a leader in the homeopathic community now for, I don't know, Dana, 30 years? Is that something close to that? Or?
Well, 31 years ago, I was arrested for practicing medicine without a license. So
31 years. So for those of you who are not familiar with Dana's work, Dana is a teacher, a world-renowned lecturer, an author, and an ongoing tireless advocate for homeopathy. As a matter of fact, Dana is the person who I first really became acquainted with in homeopathy myself, and still had homeopathic educational services and first introduced me to the books and the literature, and I am forever grateful. And Dana has been really a stalwart leader for our community now for over 30 years, and has probably done more than any other single person to advocate homeopathy throughout North America. And now recently with this new book, The Homeopathic Revolution, Why Famous People and Cultural Heroes Choose Homeopathy, Dana has really completely outdone himself because he's written, I think, probably one of the most important works for homeopathy, I think a title that has the ability to profoundly change how homeopathy is perceived by the larger public. So, Dana, thank you so much again for taking the time out of your schedule. It's greatly appreciated, and all of your work is greatly appreciated.
Thanks, Kim. One thing I want to make clear is this is not simply an ordinary book on homeopathy from my point of view. This is my most important work for a million reasons, not just because I do update our language in homeopathy and describe it in a more modern and even scientific manner, and that I also provide a pretty darn strong critique of the conventional medical model, and I question really how scientific it is. But ultimately, I uncover, you know, so many incredible stories from history as well as the present date, from people of international reputation and respect, who we all know and admire, who, for various reasons, used and or advocated for homeopathy. And we'll get into more details about all that. But
Before I actually start asking some questions, Dana, I just want to let everybody know that you can find out more about Dana's various books. He's written a number of books in homeopathy, including this more recent title, from his website, which is an excellent homeopathic website. It's homeopathic.com, so www.homeopathic.com. And it's an excellent, very rich resource for many different articles and research on homeopathy. It's something well worth visiting. So, Dana, I noticed that the foreword of your book was written by the physician to the Queen of England. And I was just curious, what's the connection between the royal family and homeopathy?
Well, that connection dates back to the 1830s, and it has been a part of the royal tradition in England for homeopathic care to be provided. And I thought when I was writing that chapter on monarchs that it was primarily going to be about the British monarchs. And I was stunned and amazed to find so many more European monarchs from Italy, from England, from the Netherlands, from France, even Napoleon III, from Germany, and from so many countries. So, yes, monarchs, of course, the American media and the European media love to both either vilify or trivialize. But the bottom line is that they can have access to any type of health or medical care that they want. And consistently, people with knowledge and with access commonly and frequently choose homeopathy.
Pretty amazing. And how did you get the physician to the Queen of England to actually write the foreword to your book?
Well, Dr. Peter Fisher is an old friend of mine. In the old days when I would visit London, I would either stay with him and or with Francis Troyhurst, another homeopath in England. And, you know, he's always been a very distinguished physician and very knowledgeable about research. He was the editor of the, it still is, the of the what was the British Homeopathic Journal, but is now our academic journal in homeopathy called Homeopathy. And then he became the medical director of the Royal London Homeopathic Hospital. And so it seemed somewhat appropriate that the royal family would seek someone of his esteem and knowledge and reputation to be their homeopath. And because he has such a long-term interest in research, and because of my long-term interest in research, coupled with my interest in studying history, it seemed to be, he really appreciated what I was bringing out, so many amazing stories of the benefits of homeopathy. Because ultimately, when you look at what we describe as the body of evidence for homeopathy, one has to look not only at double-blind and placebo-controlled clinical trials, and also the laboratory research, but ultimately history, because history provides evidence. For instance, most people don't know it, but homeopathy became popular in America and in Europe in the 19th century, primarily because of our incredible results in treating infectious disease epidemics of that era. And I'm talking about cholera, scarlet fever, yellow fever, typhoid, malaria, not the types of conditions that are that very, very well amenable to placebo treatment. And what's interesting is that the results of homeopathy were seen not just in homeopathic hospitals versus allopathic hospitals, but at the turn of the century, there were insane asylums and prisons that had supervision by doctors who were either homeopaths or allopaths. And the morbidity and mortality rates in these hospitals were considerably different. In fact, the allopathic hospitals commonly had between 2 to 6 times by percentage as many deaths as those as the homeopaths.
You know, Dana, recently the University of Connecticut held a debate, I'm sure you're aware of this, on pro and against homeopathy, and I think Andre Singh did actually an excellent job of summing up the type of work that you're describing right now, and he was actually, you know, quoting all of these very statistical studies that were, you know, demonstrated the efficacy of homeopathy relative to these other systems, and it was really quite quite impressive.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to Andre's book. I guess it's called The Weight of Evidence.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
You know, to me, it is important that we look at history. It's sort of ironic and sort of unscientific in the attitudes of so many skeptics and antagonists to homeopathy to think that historical evidence is of no benefit or no value.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they say only double-blind placebo-controlled trials are valuable.
Mm.
Now, if that were true, mind you, I should say, then we should not have anyone be conducting any surgery, because surgery is not done in a double-blind and placebo-controlled way. And just this week, the Washington Post did an article about how few drugs are tested on children. Well, there you go. Let's not allow pediatricians to prescribe drugs. And, of course, our parents, the elders. There's so little scientific evidence of the efficacy of using these drugs to treat the elders. And finally, in the year 2006, according to the Kaiser Foundation, every man, woman, and child in America was prescribed on average 12.4 prescription drugs. And when you consider that most research is not done with multiple drugs being given concurrently, then any doctor that prescribes more than one drug at a time is shooting from the hip and is not really utilizing scientific evidence at all.
Really true, isn't it? Dana, back to your homeopathic revolution. I actually haven't received my copy yet. I'm eagerly...
Eeks!
I can't wait to get it. I'm sitting here waiting. But I know you mentioned to me that you actually had some evidence that you talk about in the book, that Charles Darwin's doctor was actually a homeopath. And I was just curious if you could just share a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. In fact, I present, I think, a quite strong case to suggest that it is unlikely that Darwin could have or would have been able to finish his book, The Origin of Species, in 1859, if he didn't get homeopathic treatment from Dr. James Manby Gully 10 years previous. Now, in 1840, 1848, the end of 1848, his father died, Darwin's father died, and Darwin was so sick he couldn't even attend his own father's funeral. Then, just prior to going to Dr. Gully, his health was so severe that he had a couple years of fainting spells and spots before his eyes, and he had had 12 years of severe and persistent nausea and vomiting, persistent boils, heart palpitations. This was one sick puppy. He wrote that he could not work one out of every 3 days. All right? So a shipmate from the Beagle and his cousin, William Fox, recommends that he go see James Manby Gully, who was a hydrotherapist, or, you know, using water cure, and a homeopath. Darwin took his entire family of seven, and spent several months there. And within the first couple weeks, actually within the first 8 days, he develops a skin rash. And he's really pleased to have this skin rash because he says he notices that whenever he has a skin rash, he himself feels better. Mm. Now, for us, we homeopaths know what that means. Sure. This was a healing crisis. Mm. And mind you, he also acknowledges that he does not have, an atom of faith in homeopathy. And yet, within a month of going to this homeopath and to this in this hydrotherapy center, which is like a spa, within 1 month, he's walking 7 miles in a day, and he says, I'm becoming an eating and walking machine. Mm. Now, to a guy that had so little energy, to a guy that was having dizziness and spots before his eyes, to a guy that could hardly eat because of the persistent nausea and vomiting, this was a welcome experience.
Oh.
And so even several years later, after his homeopath retired, he still went back to this particular spa, and the homeopath who ran it, Dr. Gully, gave the medical directorship to another medical doctor who was also a homeopath. So, Darwin was, kept under homeopathic care. Of course, the skeptics ironically emphasized that Gully was a hydrotherapist. Now, ironically, it's not as though these skeptics have now become champions of water cure. and it is true that Gully was probably more known because he had this hydrotherapy spa, but he himself, what the treatment that he provided to his patients was homeopathy. He had other people provide the other treatments. But what Gully treated and used was homeopathy, especially in chronic diseases.
And does Darwin actually acknowledge the benefits of homeopathy?
He never does. Now, mind you, this is not surprising, because if you think about it, it would have been professional suicide if he did.
Yeah, yeah.
At this time, there was another physician, an allopath, who was the physician to Queen Victoria. Mm-hmm. And he was the editor of this medical journal. And he wrote a book antagonistic to homeopathy. But because he also said in this book some very kind words about Hahnemann, in fact, it's really wonderful words about how brilliant of a man he is and how impressive of a system he's created. But mind you, this was a book that was an attack book on homeopathy and attacking these nanodoses that we use. They didn't use the word nanodose. But because Sir John Forbes said anything positive about homeopathy, the doctors that subscribed to his journal stopped subscribing, and it had to close. So the evidence is that any physician or scientist who agreed to utilize homeopathic medicine simply got attacked by his colleagues and could not engage with them professionally or socially.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why, in fact, I begin this book with a quote from a former physician to the royals, a physician who was, in fact, the homeopath to 4 generations of British monarchs. And this quote is, I believe what prevents men, from accepting the homeopathic principle is ignorance. But ignorance is criminal when human lives are at stake. No honest man faced with the facts of homeopathy can refuse to accept it. He has no choice. When I had to face it, I had to become a follower. There is no choice if I were to continue to be an honest man. Truth always demands adherence and offers no alternative.
Oh, great quote, Dana. Love that.
It's a fabulous quote.
Wonderful. Well, that's very interesting about Charles Darwin. Now, I know that in your book you also talk about different types of cultural heroes, and you also talk about some of the American presidents. I think that you mentioned something like 11 of them.
Yeah, 11 American presidents all the way up to Clinton.
I mean, so we did actually have some good presidents at one point. Is that what you're...
My story about Lincoln is really quite amazing.
Because
it not only is about Lincoln, it's about his Secretary of State, William Seward, who was his most trusted ally.
Sure.
And if, for those people that really know some details about history, on the night that Lincoln was shot, his Secretary of State, William Seward, was stabbed. It was a part of a multi-person assassination plot. And in fact, the man who stabbed Seward got into his home by saying that he had a delivery by Seward's homeopath, and got into his sick bed and then stabbed him 7 times. As it turns out, the closest physician to Seward at the time was the Surgeon General of the United States, who was an allopath. And he went and he sought to treat the Secretary of State. And he did so successfully. And he also then brought in a homeopath, his homeopath, to treat him. But because the Surgeon General consulted with a homeopathic patient and also happened to provide care to this homeopathic patient with a homeopath, he was reprimanded from the AMA for doing that. Because at this time... it was not only not recommended to have any conversations, the AMA considered it ethically unethical.
Hmm. So that's a great story about Lincoln. Who else can you tell us about? Because I think the presidents is very interesting.
Well, you know, there's numerous presidents that of Harding and Hoover and McKinley and Garfield. But, you know, I don't want this to be too American-centric. You know,
yeah.
I'm real proud of the story. I finally uncovered how Gandhi got connected to homeopathy through Nehru and through one of the Shakespeare of India is a guy named Tagore. And he also introduced homeopathy to Gandhi. Now, what's interesting is Gandhi initially was skeptical of homeopathy. But then he became convinced that it was so valuable because so many of his respected friends and colleagues had told him so. And speaking of world leaders, San Martin, who's the George Washington, if you will, of South America, he liberated Argentina and Peru and Bolivia. And he, too, he wasn't a homeopath, but he was educated enough about homeopathy that he carried a homeopathic medicine kit along with him as he crossed the Andes and began liberating these different countries.
Wow.
So I'm proud that so many world leaders have become advocates for homeopathy. Now, today, I'm proud to say that Tony Blair and his family have been advocates for homeopathy. They haven't been grandstanding it. They've been very quiet about it. And his wife, Sherry Blair, is a very well-respected civil rights lawyer. And her sister is also a lawyer and a homeopath. And her sister was on the board of trustees of one of the leading homeopathic organizations. And so Sherry Blair and her sister grew up on homeopathy. And it's just a little-known fact that they have been advocates.
Very interesting. Dana, I know one story that's always a little confusing for people. I know that John... Rockefeller's physician was a homeopath.
Yeah.
And when he passed on, he gave away around, between $400 million or something around that between 1900 and 1930.
Yeah.
But almost none of that went to homeopathic medical schools.
No, none of it did.
What's up with that? Why did...
Yeah, the two longest stories in my book are of Darwin and J.D. Rockefeller. Because they are really so fascinating as individuals and their relationship to homeopathy being somewhat complex. But in fact, as it turns out, Rockefeller's first homeopath was a woman, one of the early women physicians from Ohio. And And then she passed away, and he then took on another homeopath. And ultimately, Rockefeller outlived this homeopath, who lived to a much earlier age. The homeopath lived to only 93 years of age, whereas Rockefeller lived to 97. And he became one of his best friends. And yet, as you said, during the first three decades of the 20th century, Rockefeller gave away between $400 and $500 million. And he told his philanthropic foundations that he wanted half of his money that was going to medical education to go to homeopathic sources. And he was initially assured that it was, and it never was. And in fact, in the 20th century, not a single penny, as far as I've been able to find, ever went to a homeopathic school or organization. And the details of this I laid out in the book. And, you know, it is a really sad and sad story about all this.
Mm.
Now, one of the other stories in my chapter on corporate leaders and philanthropists is a real mind-blower, too.
Mm.
And it's the story of Charles Kettering.
Mm.
Now, many of us don't know the name Kettering, but you've heard of the Sloan Kettering Clinic or the Sloan Kettering Institute. Sloan was the chairman of General Motors, and Kettering was the vice president. And Kettering was the inventor. He was the one that developed the Delco battery, and he made all of our cars electronic. He's considered, along with Edison, as the most prolific inventor in history in America. And he only sought homeopathic care. What's interesting about Kettering is that Ohio was very popular with homeopathy. And Ohio State was a public university, and they had a conventional medical school. Well, according to records, showed that about 75% of the wealth of Ohio were involved with homeopathy. In other words, all the rich people, most of the educated and literary elite, were totally into homeopathy. So they were able to encourage Ohio State in 1914 to develop a homeopathic medical school. And it was going great guns. So much so that 6 years later, in 1920, Kettering gave Ohio State $1 million specifically for their homeopathic research department.
Hmm.
Well, what do you know? The head of the AMA's Council on Medical Education makes a rapid visit to the president of Ohio State and simply gives them an ultimatum that if they continue with the homeopathic medical school, that the AMA, which was in charge of accrediting medical schools at the time, by the way, a little known and often ignored historical fact. I mean, they formerly had the fox guarding the hen house. So the president of the AMA's Council on Medical Education threatens the president of Ohio State, saying that if they continue with the homeopathic medical college, that the AMA will lower the accreditation of the allopathic medical college, which means would have serious death blow to the medical school. And at that time, a lot of schools were closing down.
Mm.
So Ohio State, in fact, chose to close the homeopathic medical school, and they had to give Kettering back his $1 million.
Wow.
Now, $1 million, of course, in 1920 money is about, what, $75 or $100 million today.
Right.
Now, when you think about that, and you also think about how much money was kept away from homeopathic schools at the turn of the century by the head of Rockefeller's foundations, this guy named Gates, you realize that this is a very serious problem. And but the bottom line is the whole book shows how so many of our cultural elite in the West and throughout the East were advocates of homeopathy. But I don't want to make it sound as though, well, only the rich and educated were involved with homeopathy, because I also like to admit that the smart and lucky poor, whoever just somehow seemed to learn about it, get turned on to it, or fall upon it in some type of shape, way, or form. So homeopathy is not necessarily any elitist medicine, But I think there is good reason that many of the smartest people, the most successful people, have sought it out and utilized it.
Very interesting. Dana, I know in your book you talk a little bit about Vincent van Gogh and his portrait of Dr. Gachet, who was his homeopath. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I mean, isn't this kind of evidence that homeopathy doesn't work if...
Yeah, van Gogh. Absolutely. You know, it is an interesting story. What happened was is that van Gogh was going insane. He was in an insane asylum. There's different theories as to why he was insane. Some people say he had syphilis. Other people say that as a painter he was ingesting a lot of paint by putting his paintbrush in his mouth, and that is a known fact. Very late in his life, literally 3 months before he killed himself, he did spend some time with this Dr. Gachet. And Dr. Gachet simply did not have enough time to elicit an adequate enough cure, and then Van Gogh, of course, killed himself. Though in the meantime, he developed a good relationship with Gachet, who was the homeopath to Monet and Renoir and Pizarro, and Pizarro's mother, who was somehow also very influential amongst these post-impressionists. And Pizarro was the real godfather of this movement and really one of the real brilliant intellectuals of that day and age. And Gachet was not just a homeopath and a physician. He was also an artist in his own way, and he respected artists and more an art collector. And some of the great museums in the world occasionally show Gachet's collection of great post-impressionist painters of that era.
Very interesting. Dana, you you suggest that Moses was the first homeopath.
It almost sounds like a joke, doesn't it?
It
really does. But here's the story, and to me, this is another one that just fits in the mind-blower category. And I now begin some of my talks with this story. That we all know, whether we read the book, the Bible, or you saw the movie, the Ten Commandments, that when Moses came down from Mount Sinai, he saw the Israelites worshiping the golden calf. And what the Bible explicitly and specifically says is that he smashed the golden calf. He ground it up. He threw it in water and had the Israelites drink the water. Now, what's also, for those of us involved with homeopathy, we know we use gold as a medicine. And what do we use it for? For hopelessness and despair, depression, and even a suicidal depression. And this was Moses' analysis of what was going on. So I'm amazed here, as a nice Jewish boy, of the inspiration behind the writing here of the Bible, that they're able to tune in with modern day or today's pharmacology, but it's also ultimately this principle of similar is an ancient principle. That I even make reference to the Oracle at Delphi, acknowledging that which makes sick shall heal.
Right.
That's
very interesting about the Oracle of Delphi.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that which makes sick shall heal. Mm. And this is an ancient principle that even Hippocrates wrote about. Now, Hippocrates was a medical historian. It's not that he was advocating one method or another. He was simply responding to and writing about the different schools of thought and practices of that up to that day and age. I am intrigued that Moses, this story about Moses, though I'll tell you, too, that in my chapter on clergy and spiritual leaders, I uncovered the story of seven different popes who used or who advocated for homeopathy. And I'm not just talking about popes in the 19th century. I bring it up to Pope John Paul, to Pope Paul, and before him, Pope Pius XII. So, in fact, one could even say that the majority of popes in the 20th century have been advocates. Mm-hmm. And, the media can and will trivialize the royal family in many different ways. But there's no way they or anyone will try and trivialize the Vatican and make it stick. They just can't.
Mm. it does seem like there have been a lot of religious and spiritual leaders who have at one point or another advocated homeopathy. Do you have any ideas on why that's the case? Or?
Well, you know, there's a lot of good reasons. I mean, first of all, the clergy and spiritual leaders tend to be more educated. Secondly, they tend to have, as a part of their worldview, a holistic view. And I know it might sound strange to those of us that try to be scientifically minded, but in fact, you know, they often do see symptoms as something that may be distressing, but that may have an underlying benefit, or they may have an underlying message that simply lopping the head off of a symptom is not necessarily the best way to deal with it.
Sure.
But I do point out that in America and in Europe, many of the leading clergy not only became advocates of homeopathy, but became clinicians of homeopathy.
Interesting.
And then my section in that chapter on clergy and spiritual leaders gets into some detail about some of the Eastern gurus, and virtually all of them were totally into homeopathy. I have a great personal story because I was the homeopath to Muktananda for a little bit, and I have a really funny story about my interaction with Satchidananda and Yogi Bhajan, and so many of these Eastern gurus were advocates, or as in the case of Bhajan and Satchidananda, they were actually trained as homeopaths before they became formally, you know, teachers of yoga and meditation.
Danny, I'm just curious, like, you probably haven't thought about this, but if you were going to count out how many people you've actually just mentioned in your book who have employed or used or advocated homeopathy to some degree, how many people do you think you're talking about?
Oh, numbers?
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, the book does go over a couple hundred people. And, you know, just to give people a sense, I mean, after I explain homeopathy, and my chapter that explains it is called Why Homeopathy Makes Sense and Works. And by the way, for those people out there that have difficulty explaining homeopathy to skeptics or to people that may not even be skeptics, but simply ask good, hard questions, you know, I've been doing this for 40 years now, almost. And so, you know, learn from how I've refined my ability to explain this. Now, I follow up that chapter with a chapter called Why Homeopathy is Hated and Vilified. And I tell some of the most incredible stories you'll ever know about what specific attacks orthodoxy did on homeopaths historically and even in the modern day. And then I get into the specific cultural heroes, beginning with literary greats, going into sports superstars, then on to physicians and scientists, go from there to stage, film, and television celebrities, musicians, artists and fashionistas, politicians and peacemakers, women's rights leaders and suffragists, corporate leaders and philanthropists, monarchs, and then the clergy and spiritual leaders. So, you know, it's a very, very rich source. And I have to say that, you know, although I have this passion for homeopathy, I also have varied and wide interests, and this book allowed me to do some of that art history and music history, and because I'm a jock, you know, to explore all these different sports and different famous, you know, world-class athletes and Olympic greats and their use of and appreciation for homeopathy. I got a chance to express my wide-ranging interests, but then connect it all together, connect the dots.
It sounds like it was really quite a fun and creative project for you, Dana.
Oh, it was, and I'm not done.
any Frisbee Ultimate heroes that...
Kim, people out there know that Kim knows that I love Frisbee. I do Frisbee ballet, but I also do Frisbee, or we call it disc golf. But, you know, I don't know.
Listen, let me ask you a real one. I know you mentioned in your book that Cher suffered from chronic fatigue syndrome and was actually cured with homeopathy. Can you tell us a little bit about that story? Because that's something very interesting for people.
Well, you know, first of all, it wasn't just chronic fatigue, but in the 1980s, Cher was suffering from frequent bouts of pneumonia. mm-hmm. and chronic fatigue, so much so that for 2 years she was unable to perform. Mm-hmm. And for those people that have followed her career, I mean, you know, this is a very vital woman who just has tons of energy. And it was very difficult for her at this stage. And she did a lot of conventional stuff that wasn't working. She finally went to a homeopath and was cured. And, you know, what's so crazy is I don't know why, but, you know, these people do have these wonderful experiences, but all too often they don't show their support for homeopathy in a meaningful way. Now, as it turns out, Cher did at least once in her life. She did give $25,000 to David Riley and to the Glasgow Homeopathic Hospital several years ago when they were undergoing a political fight in the effort of the skeptics to try and abolish the Glasgow Homeopathic Hospital. But I wish that more and more of these people with means and with names can come out of the medicine closet more and show the support.
Dane, I've heard rumors for years now, and I don't know if you can substantiate this or discredit it, but I've heard for years rumors that Magic Johnson was being treated successfully with homeopathy. Do you know much about that?
I have never heard that. Uh-huh. I have heard it, but I've never been able to verify it. As it turns out, though, his physician is an old high school friend of mine.
Uh-huh.
And I knew at least 20 years ago this high school friend who is his orthopedic surgeon, you know, thought that homeopathy was quackery. So it wouldn't have come from this guy. And, you know, I have not heard any details. And the way I did not include anybody in this book based on hearsay.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I heard from many people, for instance, that Bill Clinton and many of his friends used homeopathy. But I didn't include him initially until I uncovered an article in Business Week that made note of that a Clinton aide had gone into a New York homeopathic pharmacy for a remedy for Clinton's sinusitis. And this was at a time that he was having a lot of those frequent laryngitis problems.
Wow.
And all of a sudden, you don't ever hear about that anymore.
Mm.
And then I got a further confirmation when George Stephanopoulos, one of his, you know, leading advisors, wrote his autobiography. He made note that Hillary, during the healthcare reform movement, that Stephanopoulos was put in charge of it along with Hillary, that Hillary sent him a box of homeopathic medicines because she wanted him to stay healthy and strong during this trying time.
Wow.
So, I did not use the National Enquirer. I did not use sources that were teachable. And, you know, ultimately, every chapter has around 50 different references.
Sure.
And so this is a veritable treasure trove of information for those of us out there who want solid and verified information about homeopathy. And my explanations for how homeopathic medicines work is very different than what is commonly said or known. Because I describe here this new silica hypothesis, which I won't get into right now, but leave for another time, which is extremely provocative.
Hmm. Dana, I know that in the early 1900s that some corporations actually created medical clinics for their employees where they actually had homeopathic doctors providing the treatment. Can you tell us a little bit about that history? I know that's something a lot of people are not aware of.
Yeah.
And could you tell us why these corporations actually decided to employ homeopaths to provide treatment?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we don't have any sense, adequate sense now, of homeopathy's quite stellar stance at the turn of the century. I mean, yes, it was a minority school of thought. And yes, you know, in the nation it was only maybe about 10%. Maybe 10 to 15, but in cities it was between 15 to 25%, and it was amongst the most educated literary elite and the wealthy classes. So, this influenced corporations in a big way because the leaders of corporations were often being taken care of by homeopaths. And because at the time, too, the allopaths refused to work with homeopaths, and because many of the leaders of the corporations wanted some homeopathic care rather than offer just homeopathic and allopathic, sometimes they would just have homeopaths providing care in their clinics. And we're talking about some of the small companies like General Motors, like Montgomery Ward, like General Electric, and National Cash Register.
Oh.
So we're not talking about small guys. And but one thing that you do need to know is in my chapter on corporate leaders and philanthropists, I finally get down to what happened to all the money. How did the AMA get so powerful? And briefly, let me just tell you this. That in 1899, the AMA was a pretty disorganized and powerless group. I won't say powerless. They weren't significant. But the head of the AMA, who then became the head of the AMA and the editor of the journal for 25 years, I'm sorry to say, was a graduate from a homeopathic medical college. But he had a brilliant idea, and that was he created the AMA Seal of Approval on Drugs. Now, to get the seal of approval required no research, no evidence of safety or efficacy in any way. All you had to do to get the seal of approval is to admit what's in your drug, because they didn't like the patent medicines or where they had secret formulas. And then the bigger thing that you had to do is you had to advertise in every national, regional, and local AMA publication. This became a legalized form of bribery. And it made the AMA rich. And then, you know, 20-plus years later, a new guy took over the AMA, and he did the same thing, but he created the AMA Seal of Approval on foods. And that allowed tobacco to advertise with them. And this is the guy, that the head of the AMA, that taught the tobacco companies how to advertise. You know, 9 out of 10 doctors recommend Chesterfields and all that type of stuff. And both of these guys that became the heads of the AMA, in the last years of their involvement in the AMA, they were vilified and they were kicked out of the AMA ultimately, both of them. And their papers were often burned so that no one could find out all the shady deals that went on there. And there was one book called The Medical Mussolinis. And this is a book about these two leaders of the AMA. Fascinating story. Get the details in the chapter on on corporate leaders and philanthropists. Should we open this up for questions out there?
Dana, before we do that, though, I'm curious. You know, to me, it seems at least that this book. I mean, you've done a lot for homeopathy. I mean, so many different ways, and homeopathy wouldn't be where it is. But I think in many respects, you kind of outdid yourself with this book. And I'm curious what the response has been, because I know that for most people today, their cultural heroes are what, you know, guides them in their lives in many respects. So, you know, when you have somebody who's an advocate of homeopathy and you know the guy and you love him, I would think that this would have a kind of an impact on the larger community. So I'm curious, what type of response have you been seeing to the book?
Well, you know, people that read it absolutely love it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just trying to get the word out there more.
Mm-hmm.
Now, ultimately, what I have been doing in the last several months is I raised about $60,000 from well-wishers, from people who know that this is a powerful body of information. And so, whereas the publishers rarely do enough PR, I felt, and so did so many of people that have begun to read the book, feel that we need to do special efforts. So we hired a separate PR guy, actually a guy that helped work with Deepak Chopra when Deepak Chopra was just getting off the ground. And it's a guy that I knew professionally and have a lot of respect for, and he knew already a lot about homeopathy, so I didn't have to educate him about that. So I've been hiring him to do a bunch of stuff, and we've been able to do a lot of things. I'm going to be on the Oprah and Friends radio program with Dr. Mamet Oz, sometime in January. There's a whole bunch of other stuff going on. But I am doing fundraising now. I did create many years ago a nonprofit organization called the Foundation for Homeopathic Education and Research. And if anyone out there wants to provide a tax-deductible donation to this very important media campaign, please let us know. I'm really pleased and honored that NASH has donated money, that the National Center for Homeopathy has promotional information about this book at their website, that leaders of all the different other homeopathic organizations have either given money. And one thing that we're doing is that whenever we get interviews with local newspapers or local media, we try and then not only have interview with me, because what the plan is that the publisher is doing PR to promote the book. What the PR guy that I've hired is he's promoting homeopathy and just using the book as a tool to do that. And so I've already connected with about 30 homeopaths and got their permission to provide referrals to them for media stuff. Though, you know, I'll tell you, the antagonists to homeopathy are so strong that they've changed Wikipedia. I don't know if you follow that website.
No, tell us about that, Dana.
It's an awful write-up. They make homeopathy seem like a total quackery. Mm. And, you know, every time I try and change something, you know, they just change it back. So, you know, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And there's only so much I can do, though. I do try to do a lot. But I need help. And if other people out there, not only money, if you have time or some other expertise, connect with me. Write to me at mail@homeopathic.com. And let's open up the dialogue for how we can work together to create the revolution that we all want.
That's great, Dana. And Dana, any possibility this can be translated into other languages in the near future? Or?
Yeah, actually, there's a German company that wants to do it, and we've already did just today. I signed the contract, believe it or not, for Czechoslovakian rights, Czech rights. And we're being a bit slow in deciding which companies to work with because we're trying to be very selective, that's all.
Sure. Well, again, I want to commend you because it's even though I haven't read it yet, I know it's going to be an excellent work, and I'm eager to get mine in the mail. And
it's a great gift book, by the way.
This call, either live or recorded, to make sure that they get a copy. You can get one either from homeopathic.com or you can get it from our book website as well.
I also, by the way, you know, in this case, I don't mind it if someone buys this book from Amazon, because the better we have sales on Amazon, the more other bookstores see that the sales of it are good.
Yeah, that's a good idea, isn't it?
So I don't have a problem with
it. Yeah, I know sometimes companies will try to get all of their people to purchase from Amazon so it goes up in the rankings. Is that what it is, Dana?
Yeah. No, it's good. The bottom line, this is the type of book, by the way, that you want a couple copies. You want to give one to someone that you know. You want to give it to, you know, your father-in-law that's a skeptic. You want to give it to your older brother who's been harassing you for a long time. You know, you want to give it to the, this is the type of book that is my strongest statement I could have ever made for why homeopathy makes sense and works, and both from the scientific point of view and from the words and experiences of the most respected people of our day and age.
That's wonderful. All right, Dana, let me open it up and let some other people ask you some questions. Hold on just 1 second. Hi, can you guys hear me? Hello?
Yes.
Hi. Does anybody have a question for Dana Ullman?
What I wanted to ask you guys is there a link I would love to advertise this book on our website, which is miamibeachpediatrics.com. Is there a link?
Yes. There's a website that's dedicated just to this book, and it's called homeopathicrevolution.com. Now, you'll see at this website 7 quotes from 7 people, including a professor at Harvard, one at Stanford, one at Georgetown. And you'll also see the complete table of contents, and you'll see all the famous people in each of the chapters. And then also you'll see one free sample chapter. I put the chapter on literary greats because I wanted people to know that many of the smartest people are literary heritage, East and West, have been advocates for homeopathy.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Great.
So that's homeopathicrevolution.com.
Okay, very good. And we also have our shopping cart actually with Amazon, so the book is sold on
that's
Amazon.
Right. Yeah, you please encourage. Yeah, that's fine. I'm real pleased.
Okay, good, very good.
Did you have another question, Karen?
No, that was it.
Okay.
That was it.
Great. It was a great call, wasn't it?
It was great. It
yeah.
was so interesting, and I absolutely loved the part about Moses, which I don't know how I never realized. But it's just so brilliant, and it makes so much sense.
That's right.
Unbelievable.
That's right. I'll tell you, you can open up a talk with that story, and you'll immediately have, you know, big advocates for you right there. Especially if you're in Florida, any part of the South. But ultimately, so many parts of the world, this makes sense.
Yeah, I get a lot of, actually, here in Miami Beach, we have, I see a lot of religious Jews, not just Jews. And so for them, it's it would be very interesting to hear.
Right. By the way, in that chapter on clergy and spiritual leaders, I also have four very well-known and respected rabbis. But what's a real mind-blower is in that chapter, I give reference to a leading Muslim cleric who is the head of this one group of Muslims for 23 years. Now, this is a smaller Muslim sect of only 10 or 20 million Muslims. Of course, that's a lot, but it still is a smaller Muslim sect. And as it turns out, this leader, the spiritual leader of this whole group, was a homeopath, and he wrote a 700-page Materia Medica.
Oh, wow.
So I love the fact that leading Eastern gurus, Western clergy, Muslim leaders, rabbis, are appreciative enough about homeopathy, and I can't help but wonder if homeopathy can be part of the common ground that we all look for and hope for in the world to bring us together, because, you know, we have too many things that separate us.
That would probably be the only tool that can bring us together, because that would create real healing. But is that going to really happen?
Well, I don't know. You know, the bottom line is, you know, we have to look for common ground opportunities.
Right.
And this is one of them.
Very nice. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dana.
My pleasure.
Other questions for Dana?
Yes. Dana, this is David Kramer calling.
David, what a nice and pleasant surprise.
Well, what a great...
David?
Yes. Hi, Kim. So, well, congratulations, Dana. I think this book has been... about 50 years in coming, but it's something that I think is a real shot in the arm, and I want to congratulate you. And even in this discussion tonight, it was you've clarified a salient fact for me that I've been under misconception for most of my life, which is I thought Moses had took the tablets, and I see now he's taking the pellets.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, my joke is that it was a tenth potency, 10C.
10C.
Ten Commandments, I love it.
You know, all this year they've mistranslated. It did say tablets, but they thought that was stone tablets, and it really was medicinal tablets.
Right, exactly. But I see this as a bridge work between the struggle that homeopathy is now in the United States and the need for what I consider to be complementary medicine, an integrative medicine.
Yeah, I don't like the word complementary because it always makes it seem as though natural therapies are complement conventional medicine rather than the other way around.
Are we referring to the allopaths as being complementary?
That's right. That's what I like to prefer.
Okay. But we're still working on, I don't know if it's come down to you through the grapevine, we're trying to start up a hospital, a legitimate hospital of integrative medicine called the Maristica Institute. And I think that your book will be very handy and helpful in making people and allowing people to bridge the gap and being clear about the real efficacy and value of homeopathic treatment, and that it has a very long and prestigious track record. So I appreciate your tremendous efforts, and I wish you the best of luck with that.
Thanks
a
lot.
Did you get your copy yet?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't get my copy yet.
You did get a copy. Okay, great.
Yeah.
So,
hey, anybody else have any questions? We just have a couple more minutes, so maybe one more question. Anybody have a question for Dana?
Yes, Dana.
Yes.
This is Mary Terhune from Boston. And I have a question. I've really always thought of homeopathy as part of Western medicine, given that Hahnemann was a medical doctor. And I'm wondering how you feel about that.
Well, I mean, its origins are in, out of, Hahnemann, and its principle of similars is Eastern, Western, it's cosmic. I mean, there's reference to the principle of similars in ancient Sanskrit, in ancient writings. I make reference to that in my clergy and spiritual leaders chapter. So it is worldwide in terms of the principle. Though ultimately, it did evolve out of the Western European and then American scientific and medical model, but rather than being a reductionistic one, it was an empirical and holistic method.
Right. But
now, you're from Boston, by the way. You know Boston University used to be a homeopathic medical school.
Yes, I do.
And I'm real proud of that.
Because I'm going to give a talk where I'm suggesting that the new paradigm is that homeopathy and allopathy be, that there's a reunion under the umbrella of Western medicine, that it's reunited under that umbrella.
Well, sure. I mean, ultimately, homeopathy is a Western medicine. Now, I call homeopathy also nanopharmacology now, because nano is the only word in our English language which means both very small and very, very powerful. Now, some of the skeptics of homeopathy incorrectly assert that nano means 1 billionth. Now, that's only one of its definitions. No one ever told Steve Jobs that the nano music device is, that can't be called nano because it's bigger than a billionth of a whatever. No, the bottom line is the word nano, its origination means dwarf. It means very small. But in nomenclature, it means very small but very powerful.
Right. Thank you.
Great. Well, I think we're out of time. Dana, I want to thank you again. You did a wonderful job of giving us an overview of your wonderful new book. I'm really excited to receive it in the mail myself, and I encourage everyone who listens to the call either live or later on our website to purchase a copy for themselves. This is really a seminal work that has the ability to profoundly change homeopathy for all of us. So thank you again, Dana, and thank you for everyone for joining us on the call this evening.
Thank you, Dana. Thank you, Kim.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.